Welcoming Rabbi Moshe Aberman at 9 o'clock sharp on Thursday morning as we zip along with Zoom with your father Gishkolo, and Rabbi Moshe will give us another enlightening shiur. Maybe it's still Rishonim?
Yes, we're still Rishonim, especially since we got cut off last time in the middle.
That's right. We hope that the Wi-Fi stays good. It's in literature with the Rishonim.
So we're going to continue with the Rishonic literature and continue with the halachic works of the Rishonim. Last time we spoke slightly about the Rif, and primarily most of what there was to say about the Rosh, both of them being in the category of halachic books that follow the order and are written alongside the order of the Shas. There are other works of that sort, but these are the two that I'm going to mention in this context. What I did want to tweet in reference to the Rosh, I said that the Rosh's centrality and importance expressed itself also with the fact that there was commentary written around it. Most of it was written in later periods in the Achronic period, but there were some in the Rishonic period. We mentioned the work of his son, Rabbi Yaakov, who we'll meet a little later in a different context. But he wrote the Kitzur Piskei HaRosh, a summary of the halachic focus of what the Rosh did, because the Rosh had written a lengthy discourse around the whole sugya. In it was a direction of his halachic ruling, but sometimes it's difficult if you're not well embedded in the learning to identify what the halacha is. And what his son did was basically create a kitzur, a sort of summary that brings in the halachic focus of the Rosh's rulings. We find later and in other times similar kind of things that different Talmidei Chachamim did. Chaim David HaLevi did this a similar kind of thing. He wrote lengthy halachic books, and then he has a kitzur Shulchan Aruch of Chaim David HaLevi, and there's a similar kind of thing that Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef in his books also has a kitzur. So that this is a model that was taken afterwards and created as part of a way of presenting halacha, the more elaborate and the more concise. But in any case, the Rosh himself only wrote the more elaborate. His son wrote the kitzur. Another important Rishonic commentary to the Rosh that is worth being aware of is the Hagaot Oshri, Aleph Shin Reish Yud, Rosh Hashanah, written by Rabbi Israel Mikarmis, lived in the beginning of the 14th century. I don't know of exact dates of when he lived.
What country?
Now, one second, Bruce. The name Hagaot Oshri needs some attention. Hagaot is comments. Oshri was the name that the work of the Rosh is related to in Halach. In other words, the Rosh is Piskei HaRosh, in many books are written as the Oshri, right? Rabbeinu Asher. So the Hagaot Oshri is Hagaot on the Oshri, on the halachic work of the Rosh. Yes, Bruce.
What country was he writing from?
To the best of my knowledge, he was actually the Hagaot Oshri may have been in Austria. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but I meant Ashkenaz or Sfard is what I was.
Oh, the Ashkenaz. Uh-huh. It's very Ashkenaz, and that's where I was going to get to. The work, the Hagaot, is, even though the Rosh himself, ironically, is seen by the Beit Yosef later on as a representative of Ashkenazic halachic ruling, the Rosh, because of his broad exposure, has a lot of Sephardic influence in his rulings. And therefore comes Rabbi Yisrael Mekaymis and writes the Hagaot Ashri to bring forward the more classic Ashkenazic rulings, and he includes them in some of the key Ashkenazic poskim, such as the Ravya, Rabbi Elazar ben Yoel Halevi, who lived between 1140 and 1220, in other words, relatively early Rishon in Germany. His book, the Ravya, is called in other halachic places the Avi Ezri. If you buy it today, if you went to the store today, you would look for the Ravya. Or as Mori Rabbi Zichron Levracha, Rabbi Lichtenstein used to say, the Ravya. Right? But the Ravya is called by other poskim the Avi Ezri. That was its formal name. That was a Sefer Halacha that the Hagot Ashri points out, so that you see sometimes the differences in the rulings of Ashkenaz and the Rosh. Another book he uses is the Or Zarua of Rabbi Yitzchak ben Moshe, Or Zarua, who lived in the middle of the 13th century. And he also quotes Baalei HaTosfot, which are usually, even though they're in France, they are usually connected with the Ashkenazic ruling as opposed to the Sephardic ruling. Yes, please.
So if you didn't know, like I wouldn't know, and you're in a Jewish bookstore and you're skimming through books, how could you tell an Ashkenazi halachic book from a Sephardi halachic book? Is there certain trends or differences that jump out at you that would indicate something like that?
No. Without knowledge of either the patterns of halachic ruling and looking at specific things, or just a familiarity of the groupings of who came from where, you wouldn't know. If you walked into a store and looked at the book, in most cases, you will find either in the front opening page, it will give the name and often where the person's from. Or if you look a little further, it's often, especially in later and newer scientific editions, there is some kind of introduction and opening that will give you that information.
Because you had mentioned earlier in the trend of Ashkenazi rulings versus Sephardi rulings. And what does that mean exactly? It's just really the trend of transmission. There's no particular difference in the halachic conclusions.
There are different halachic conclusions. There's no real difference as a whole in the process of halacha, but it's when there are different questions or different views, at times there is a question of how you understand a particular Gemara and therefore what conclusions you come to, or preference that exists sometimes when there are different views and different rules of thumb or considerations for how you're posek, you might find differences. So that the approach is the same, the halachic conclusions might differ. What you will see is usually a tradition. In other words, because there's an aspect of a student and the rabbi, you will find that posek follows his predecessors in a general direction, so that you will find a line of psak, and let's say on a certain topic, you will usually find a certain direction that most or many Sephardic poskim will rule one way, and most or many Ashkenazic poskim will rule differently. It's not absolute. We'll find places where there are certain Ashkenazic poskim that rule like the Sephardim like Ashkenazi. You will find mixes, but because of the natural learning process, right, when I'm taught something and my Rebbe has a certain tradition, he has to go a certain direction, I will lean in that direction unless I come to a conclusion that I don't think he's right. So that it creates a certain halachic tradition. There is one small aspect, and that's that's open for debate. If the Ashkenazic halachic world was more influenced by the rulings of halacha and Eretz Yisrael, as opposed to the Babylonian, which affected the Spanish, the Sephardic Sikha. But that's not, again, their views in reference to that, it hasn't been, I think, well enough established to say it is absolute. I tend to believe that it is so, but I have to say it with a certain element of reservation.
There's obvious differences that jump out at me would be the halakhic questions around kidneyot or waiting between meat and dairy, which seems to be
first
very
of all,
different.
Meat and dairy, I don't know that there's differences. Meat and dairy, I don't know there's differences.
Well, the Dutch got to 1 hour. I learned that from Italy, from the north, and up and down.
I think you can find the views of 1 hour also in Sephardic literature. And there are definitely a lot of Ashkenazic poskim who also get to the 6 hours. Reb Moshe Feinstein, okay, so yes, I'm talking about Nachron, but Reb Moshe Feinstein, a Ashkenazic, clearly Ashkenazic posek, writes, if somebody doesn't have a custom from home, then the more correct aspect is to do 6 hours.
No, I meant in the days of the Rishonim.
I understand, but the point is that it wouldn't, if the Ashkenazic, the main stay of the Ashkenazic psika was not to wait 6 hours, Reb Moshe Feinstein would not have written. In other words, 6 hours is heavily embedded in the Ashkenazic system. It's in the Sephardic system. There is a recognition of other possibilities because of how to read the sugya in both traditions. Basically, I'm not getting into the details of it completely, but I will make a comment that there's the 1 hour shita. It's basically based on it's a chumrah on the most absolute understanding of the sugya, misa'uda la'su'uda, from one meal to the next meal, and add in a certain chumrah of waiting a while. The 3 hour shita, which truly comes from, and it seems to be a later Germanic custom, the usual interpretation of it is that it's basically a compromise between from meal to meal to the 6 hours. I don't think that's the case. I think compromise would be a very belittling halachic perspective of what really happened there. I believe that they're simply interpreting from meal to meal, misuda suuda, according to their structure of eating meals. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Germanic or the what we call the Yekke customs of eating, but in some of the kibbutzim, some of the older kibbutzim, where there was a strong Germanic presence and influence, a very common thing was they would have breakfast. Then they had what they called aruchat eser, and around 10 o'clock they would eat light meal, something light. Then they would have lunch. Then they would have an aruchat arba in the afternoon. And in kibbutzim, that was a big thing. Right? Family gets together around the aruchat arba. And then later they would eat supper. And if you take that, you spread it over the day, you check, you get approximately 3 hours from meal to meal. I believe that's the real basis of that Germanic custom. But again, these are just customs that develop. They exist.
Yeah, but in terms of customs, do we have any idea how the Rishonim, how before the Rishonim, what was done? How far back could we know what the custom was between meals?
I have another question.
One second, guys, one at a time. Okay, let me finish with Bruce. Just one more comment to what Bruce asked. Kidneyot is an aspect of a customs that develop, and therefore they're different. It's not a halachic ruling, but it's a custom that develops and gzeirot that come about, which in many cases in that situation, a gzeirot is accepted in certain communities and not in other communities, especially where there might be a difference of reality, what was found or wasn't found, or other behavioral patterns that apply to it. As far as Arthur's question, I'm quite sure that if you wanted to track down what the halachic norms, you could do it in many, or in most cases, in the halachic aspect. You just have to look back to what is written. Not every detail, because there are things that evolve or develop as questions in halacha later on, which were not necessarily a serious aspect in the Rishonic period. But those things that are definitely part of the Rishonic halachic reality and their dealings, I believe that if you track them down, and in many cases you'll find it. There's the Ramah will bring a halachic ruling that's different than the Shulchan Aruch, and he'll bring back some of the sources that he has. And for those sources, you can often go back and find earlier sources for such a ruling. So you might not be able to get absolute pictures, but you can get quite a clear and quite a significant movement backwards to track up halachic rulings.
And I have a question. Okay, now it's obviously eating, for waiting 3 hours between meat and milk is obviously kosher, it's okay. Why can't I pick that minhag to do that? Why if it's obviously okay? My kids ask this question all the time.
Okay, the problem is you're asking a question that takes us off very much off track from what we're actually trying to do here.
We were told it's okay.
Was that?
I asked that child, and because my kids gave me the same hard time. And I was told, you know what? For the unity of the family, get three of your friends together and declare whatever declaration, I forget what was done, and take on 3 hours. We did that many years ago already.
I disagree with whoever gave you that shakalacha.
Remember, okay. I don't have a mesorah for my family.
I understand. But first of all, you had already obviously developed some kind of minhag.
It was 5 hours plus for when we were first
married. Secondly, as I mentioned, at least Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva is that when you don't have a family tradition, the correct thing is to wait 6 hours.
That's because he waited 6 hours?
I assume that he waited 6 hours. Oh, again, 6 hours.
Yeah, in other words, if you're going to ask him the shaila, he's going to tell you what he does as the answer.
No, if you look at Rav Moshe's tshuva, you'll see why he doesn't present just, because I think that way. He presents what his reasoning to think that the 6 hours is the more accurate consideration. Again, in reference to your question, Avi, there is a play in halacha between the halachic ruling and the power of minhag and custom, both of family custom and community custom. And those are the things that sort of dictate how we go. So if you truly went, said, you know, until now, and like Bruce, and for X amount of time, I kept 5 and something hours or 6 hours or whatever it might be. And now I'm changing and I'm doing a Hatarat Nedarim, so there's no aspect of Minhag Tov Shenahagti. And I'm going because I really believe there's no reason not to do just an hour, like the Dutch. Okay? Halachically, purely halachically, there is validity to what you would do. But the problem is that the minhag aspect, the custom, which is also a consideration in dictating the way we do things here, would be somewhat limiting in making such a move, and it would be make it a little more problematic in doing such a thing. Before you could do such a thing, okay, you would have to also distinguish between what is the more accurate definition of the halacha versus coming and saying that something specific is not correct. In other words, there are issues where there are different halachic views, there are different opinions, and in certain places, a certain process or a certain opinion became embedded. But in most places, that custom was not accepted. There is halachic basis to say you wait 1 hour. In 90-something percent of Jewish communities, that was not accepted. Right? In a small group of communities, I don't know if it was only the Dutch, but a small group of communities, that's what was accepted. So where it was accepted, you can't come and say that the person who's doing it is going against halacha. There's halachic grounds for what they're doing. This is the custom that was accepted. They're doing it. But to come and say that others should do it when the accepted halachic ruling tends not to take that position would be somewhat problematic. We have, for example, in the Gemara tells us, in reference to Basar Rachala, right? Communities and places where they didn't behave in the way we are, as far as, let's say, chicken and milk or things like that, right? In those places, the Gemara says, you're in that place, then it's fine. But yet, nobody today would even consider doing it because the halachic acceptance, both as far as minhag and the preferred halachic ruling, the majority leaned in a certain direction. So therefore, technically speaking, Avi, if you said, you know what, I kept the 6 hours or whatever, something, 5 and something hours within that realm of the 6 hours for many years, but now I'm doing a Hatarat Darim and I want to do the 1 hour or the 3 hour. You would have a problem with the concept of Al Titosh Torat Mecha, in other words, the idea of not negating accepted minhagi. But that's a lesser issue, and in certain places where there's a minhag and you come to a conclusion the minhag is wrong, or the, where the sociological changes have created that minhag doesn't have to be kept, you don't keep it. But I still think that that would be a situation where no one could say you're over an isur of basar v'chala. But if you asked me, would that be a correct thing to do? I would say no, because these are not the central opinions in halacha. What you're doing is you're putting yourself in a situation that you're so mech on the minority opinions in halacha with, where previously you were behaving in a way that was more in the center or more
when acceptable. You're weighing things like shalom bayit or against that, that's the issue.
Those are considerations that have to always be taken into account. When you turn to a posek and he gives you an answer, if he's serious, he will also hear all the considerations. And
so that's what happened with me. I mean, that was the issue.
Okay. Again, I don't know. It depends also what you consider slow bite.
Well, my wife wanted to switch to accommodate the kids so the family could all be
at
the same time.
Okay, Bruce,
she's very unhappy if we wouldn't do it. So
that's not our topic here, but I'll just comment that I'm not sure how much slow bite that is, because what you're saying is that your wife wanted to accommodate the kids. The kids are not the ones who...
Well, it's hard to say exactly what generated what. But at the end of the day, this became a big problem. And the posek I went to said, you know what, let's fix this problem. The halacha is wide enough to accommodate all positions here.
That's exactly right. See, that's the line. The halacha is wide enough to accommodate positions. The question is, to what extent, l'chatchila, again, you might come and say we had special circumstances that created a problem. Maybe that was what was behind the ruling. As a whole, if somebody came and said to me, oh, can I just change? I would tend to say, don't.
Yeah, I mean, no one just flips a coin. I mean, that's not what anyone's doing here.
No, that's for sure not. But the question is, can you, even if you believe that that's, you know, good basis, should you change against the normative halachic ruling? But okay, that's as much as I'm going to say on this topic for now. Let's see, you know, it's an issue that can be discussed in other settings. Let's get back to our issue of the Rishonic books in halacha. So as I said, the Haggad Ashri brings forward some of the classic Rishonic halachic rulings in the context of the Rosh, usually associated with the Ashkenazic ruling, but is influenced more by Sephardic ruling. Now we'll move on to the other direction, the ruling or books of halacha that did not follow the order of Shas, but took topics. In certain cases, it's that they took one or two or a set of topics and wrote a book on it. And sometimes it's a broader work of halacha in reference to a broader context of the halachic world, but re-ordering or resetting it as opposed to the Gemara. And we'll try to give a few examples and understand some of the Rishonim that we're familiar with to get a feel of this. I'll start with the earliest image, Rashi. Now, Rashi, in most people's mind, if you say Rashi, you ask literature of Rashi, I'll tell you his Perush HaTorah, they'll tell you of his Perush to the Gemara. Much less people are aware of his Tshuvot. He wrote Responsa in Halacha. But there's also several books that are called Mibet Midrashot Shel Rashi. In other words, they are viewed as Rashi's halachic rulings, but not as viewed as Rashi completely writing, or if he wrote, not editing the books. And two such examples that I'll mention here are the Sefer HaOra, okay, that it's not clear who edited it, but one of his Talmidim, his immediate Talmidim did. The book is divided into two parts, two sections. One is deals with topics that we today would associate with Orach Chaim. You know, things like Brachot, Chagim, you know, the daily halachic behavior. And the other is topics which we would find today in Yoredeya. It could be issues of Kashrut, it could be issues of Pidyon HaBed, and things like that. So the Sefer HaOra is a halachic work that parallels, not all, but parallels a lot of topics of Orach Chaim and Yoredeya. Another book associated with Rashi is the Machzor Vitri. The word Machzor, Chozer, already indicates that this here, there's a focus a lot on Tefillah and the whole year process, the cycle of the year. Okay, so Rashi already writes or deals with halachic works, and he does it in a direction of taking a topic, collecting the sources from the Gemarot, but not following the order of the Shas. But when we talk about this type of work, I think that the one of the two most outstanding books in that sense is the Rambam's book, the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam. Okay. The Rambam also, by the way, in halachic works, also wrote Tshuvot. You also have Tshuvot of the Rambam. But without any question, his great work, and the Rambam himself sees this as his center. I know that the philosophers like to put the Morin Avochim at the forefront of the Rambam. The Rambam himself quite clearly indicates that his center is the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah is a unique work in halacha in that, as opposed to, and I'm not familiar with any other work of halacha since the Mishnah that encompassed all areas of halacha, including areas of halacha that are not practiced today. In other words, things like Zrayim, Peah, Peah is practiced a bit today, but all the issues of Zrayim that we don't find, let's say, in the Bavli, areas of Tumah and Tahara, area of Kodshim, of Korbanot, Menachot, and all of that is found in the Mishnah Torah. The Rambam deals with them in the same way as he deals with monetary issues, deals with Chagim, and he deals with Tefillah, and he deals with Pidyon HaBen, or Mila, or Mezuzah, or whatever it might be. What the Rambam did, but, was restructure this whole halacha. It's where Rebbe divided it into six sections and subdivided each of those six sections into what we know as the Masechtot today. Probably due to the fact that in the learning process, a lot of associative aspects and entered in with the Mishnah and the Gemara. And therefore, when you learn an area of Gemara, you can learn, let's say, take example of something I'm learning with somebody. You take Moed Kata, right? You can learn the Moed Kata and very quickly get into issues of Shvi'it, issues of Tumah Tahara. That's things that are not necessarily directly connected to what is done or isn't done in Chol HaMoed. And what the Rambam attempts to do is to create a halachic work which concisely and directly tell you the principles of what is to be done in different areas of halacha. And he divides his book into 14 sections. 14 sections is the source of the other name that the Mishnah Torah is called, the Yad HaChazaka, Yudalid Sfarim. Or each of those 14 sections are subdivided into halachot, which then each area of halacha, the prakim and the halacha. As I said, the Rambam in some of these areas, Tumah v'Tahara, right, he writes on Tumah v'Tahara. He writes in Korbanot and Avoda, he writes about the Mikdash, and he writes about the Korbanot as if he's writing a halachic book that at the time the Mikdash exists. But the Rambam is aware that he stands at a different time. And in certain places, he infuses the two together. An interesting place, for example, is in reference to Leil HaSeder. Okay? And I want to just give you that example. The Rambam in Hilchot Chametz Matzah, in Perek Chet, gives us the order of how Leil HaSeder should go. He opens up Sidur Asiyat Mitzvot Elu B'Leil Chamisha Asalka. The order of doing the mitzvot on the night of the Seder, the 15th, is as follows. And then he starts telling us all the details of how the Seder should be. He gets to Halacha Vav, and he gets to Rachatz, Netilat Yadayim. So the Chakach Mevarechan Netilat Yadayim, Vinotel Yadav, he tells us you wash your hands a second time because you washed it earlier. And then he says, Lokeach Shnei Rekikim, takes two things of bread, Cholek Echad Mehen, divides one of them, breaks them, slightly different than our custom, Umeniach Paus Letoch Shalem, and puts the broken one into the whole one, because they're matzot, more like pitot, Umevarech HaMotzi Lechem Yaretz. There's the HaMotzi. I'm skipping a little bit. V'acharkach Korech Matzah Umaro. He goes to Korech. Notice what's missing. What's missing here? We said Hamotzi, and we said Korech. What's missing? Matzah. Right? Is Hamotzi? Why we say Motzi Matzah Korech? And the Matzah is missing here. And it's intentional. And he says V'achakach Korech Matzah Umaror Keechad Utabel Bechoset. Eating matzah umaror together, he says it. Notice he brings a bracha al achilat matzot umarorim. Do we make such a bracha? No. Why? Because ours is only a zecher lemikdash. He's talking about at the time of the mikdash. At the time of the mikdash, Rambam holds that eating al matzot umerorim yochluhu means literally eating matzah and maror together. And therefore he doesn't have the issue of matzah because the matzah is part of the maror. Okay. I'm skipping again a bit. And then in the beginning of Halacha Zayin, the Rambam says, V'achar kach mevarech. Listen to this bracha. Baruch ata Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam. Asher kidshanu b'mitzvotah v'tzivanu al Achilat ha-zevach. Ve'ochel mibsar chagigat 14 tchilat. In other words, there's a zevach that besides the Korban Pesach, they would bring a zevach shlami. That's eaten first. but it's part of the mitzvah of the night, and therefore you make a bracha. Here the Rambam is talking about as if we're sitting around the night of a Seder at the Mikdash. And then he continues, and the Rambam, interestingly, introduces that we eat some of the shlamin, and then we eat Pesach. Later, does he talk about eating the meal? And then there's an afikoman. And it's mashma the Rambam, again, it's mashma in itself, but it's mashma the Rambam that you eat the Korban Pesach twice. You eat some of it in the beginning and some of it at the end of the meal. But in any event, after he's brought us the Korban Shlami, and he's brought the Korban Pesach, in Halacha Chet, writes the Rambam, Bizman hazeh, when today when we don't have a korban, therefore, after saying hamotzi, so today when we don't have a mikdash, now we have this issue of achilat matzah. Right? Now we understand the seder that we have. Motzi matzah, umetabel matzah. His whole idea that everything is always mituba b'charoste, the chozel medorech al achilat maror, a bracha on eating the maror, umetabel maror b'charoste b'ochem, because matzah has to be eaten separately from the perspective of b'erev tochum matzot, and then midrabanan we eat the maror, so make a bracha midrabanan, and that's how he continues. So we see that the Rambam interfuses the time of the Mikdash, and that's how he presents innately the Leila Seder, but says, Isman HaZeh, we act differently. So in the Rambam, there's no distinction from his point of view of the validity or the necessity to present halacha of all areas, and that's what he does in his Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah, as we all know, received a very central place in halachic ruling and in the halachic world, and therefore also received a lot of attention from later halachic personalities in two directions, both in aspects of reservation and commentary. The Ravid writes, as we all know, alongside the Rambam is always printed the Hasagot HaRaivit. The Raivit in certain areas has very strong reservations in reference to the Rambam and makes sometimes very harsh comments in which he disagrees with the Rambam. But again, only because he respects the Rambam's position so much does he bother to relate to the Rambam. And then we have books, even in the Rishonim, obviously there are up to today books written on the Rambam in the Achronim, but in the Rishonim, we have works written on the Rambam where the commentary on the Rambam is usually focused on two aspects. Not completely, but usually focused on two aspects. One is the biggest fault from most people's perspective in the Rambam, and that is the Rambam does not present in any way where from where or how he got to his rulings. He brings it as a given, as this is the halacha. As far as the Rambam is concerned, this is the absolute truth, and this is the halacha. Where do you get this from? In many cases, and that's what's brought about many, many lengthy discourses on the Rambam and shiurim that are given, because in many cases, the Rambam rules something, and when you look at the sugyot, and you look at everything around it, the Rambam doesn't make sense. You have to try to understand, where the Rambam got this from. A lot of the works that were written are attempts to find the sources and the basis for the Rambam's rulings. And the other aspect is an aspect of responding to those who had reservations, such as the Ravid, on what the Rambam said, to try to explain or justify the position of the Rambam. Yes, Moshe.
Maybe if we would ask the Rambam he would say that's not the absolute truth. This is just my opinion, so to speak, and you're welcome to have your own opinion, meaning it's not really that black and white. And that's why the sources aren't listed, because he's saying, listen, you can argue and have your own opinion. That's okay. And I'm not even listing my sources. This is simply my opinion, my conclusion, as opposed to the absolute truth, as you stated earlier.
It's a very nice idea that stems from the thinking that is quite prevalent, at least in certain circles today. There are those who don't, they think that they know the truth and there's only the truth in their world. But there are certain directions of thinking in halachic world, especially those who are affected by the academic world, to be open.
I just came up with this myself this moment. I'm not affected by
to be open to other views. But I would be surprised if the Rambam said that.
Why? I mean, why is that a reasonable idea?
One second. When you read things that he writes in his introductions, things that he sometimes does comment, there are certain places where he expands a little bit in his commentary, brings on opinions. And the Rambam was not hesitant in blowing away anybody who he didn't agree with. I don't think that was what was behind the Rambam's thinking. I think you read what he basically, if you take it to an extreme, and I don't believe that's what the Rambam intended to the extreme. If you take to extreme what the Rambam writes about his Mishnah Torah, when you take it to extreme and some people read it that way, the Rambam says you can throw out the Gemara. You take my book, throw out the Gemara, you don't need anything else. All you need is my book. But I don't think that's what the Rambam meant. I think the Rambam meant as far as ruling. But when you see things like that, it's quite obvious that the Rambam is not saying, no, there are many different things. I'm just bringing my opinion, so therefore it doesn't make a difference where I got it. Secondly, even if that were the case, it still makes a difference. Because when I want to try to understand your opinion, I need to understand its grounding, its sources. So that's a major fault in the Rambam, to the extent that when the Beit Yosef went to write his book, the Beit Yosef, he writes it. His original intention was to write it on the Rambam. And then he ruled it out because the Rambam is so lacking in these sources and so unclear as far as that. And that's why he wrote it on the basis of the Tur, which we'll get to. And he wrote a different work, the Kesef Mishneh, which is borderline Rishonic Achronic in reference to the Rambam, doing the things that I mentioned before, trying to find and understand the basis and the background for the rulings of the Rambam and answering reservations of the writer. I'll mention
referencing it back to Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, where even they in the Gemara agreed that there's more than one conclusion. And Beit Hillel, we suppose we follow them because, I don't know, they were like nicer. They stated the opinion first. It's a very interesting conclusion, what to do with ultimate truth, but they're nicer about it.
First of all, let's not take things out of context. I don't know that an opinion of Beit Shammai or Beit Hillel, I think you can find even sources that will show some very harsh attitudes towards each other in the sense of how you rule and how you look at things. What is brought, and sometimes it's blown out of proportion, what is brought is that they didn't rule out and didn't disqualify the others as legitimate truths. In other words, they would intermarry with each other and things of that sort. But I don't think that in their halachic struggle, they always embraced each other all that much.
Okay? No, I'm just pointing out that there's no absolute truth in that sense. That's really the 70 faces to Torah. It relates back to Avi Pfeiffer's question. There's multiple conclusions in halacha, and that's how we see different minhagim. Even I mean, there's more than one.
First of all, there are things that are seen as almost absolute in halacha when a certain tradition of halacha takes place. That itself creates a certain given aspect of halacha. You can't go back today and say, oh, there's a shita of Rabbi Yossi in the Gemara, and therefore I'm going to, it's legitimate, and I'm going to start eating chicken with milk, or cook my chicken with milk. Okay? That would be incorrect halacha. You would be seen as over avera in that sense, even though such an opinion exists. There is a certain establishment of halach ruling. Once it becomes established, that's demanding of people in of itself. But that doesn't touch the perspective of when someone is writing his halachic book or his work, if he sees this work as this is the way it should be. Yes, others had their opinions, but really. Now, obviously the Rambam had respect for other Talmidei Chachamim. The Rambam didn't, completely... He wasn't, let's put it this way, he wasn't a Rav Yosef who called people reforming. Right? Those are Rishonim. And I say it outright, those are Rishonim. That's not the Rambam. The Rambam and the Ravid have certain exchanges that are almost as harsh. But that doesn't change the fact that when the Rambam writes his book, it's quite clear that the Rambam sees this is the halach rule as such. And he's not writing it with a kind of, oh, this is my opinion. You can go this way, that way, you can go that way. That wasn't the Rambam's thing. I think that there are enough indications that wasn't the Rambam's thing. In any event, going back to our issue, some of the commentaries, just to familiarize you with some names on the Rambam itself, one is Rabbeinu Manoach ben Yaakov, who lives at the end of the 13th century and writes a commentary, a very solid commentary, but it doesn't cover all areas of the Rambam. Another work, the Magid Mishneh, a well-known work on the Rambam, of Rabbeinu Vidal di Tolza, lived from 1283 to 1360, and you find it in almost any printed editions of the Rambam, the Magid Mishneh. And as I said, borderline Rishonot is Rabbi Yosef Karo's book, the Kesef Mishneh. Rabbi Yosef Karo, who lived from 1488 to 1575, so it's sort of the end and the beginning of the Cholim period, and when we get to the Cholim, I'll speak about that. I'll just mention, to understand this issue, many people are not aware that the Kesef Mishneh is the same author as the Beit Yosef in the Shulchan Aruch. And to the extent that there was once a organization in the United States which brought together for social purposes and Shabbatonim young Orthodox students, mostly those who had studied in yeshivot and seminaries in Israel, were back studying in university and Shabbatonim. The idea was also to give sort of a support group of those who theoretically aspired to come in Aliyah. Many of them did, many didn't, but that's a side discussion. There's a story there that I've heard from several people who were present. A girl who felt that, there's no reason girls shouldn't be giving the great Torah just as well as boys, and it was fine. And she gave this whole lengthy Dvar Torah where the theme was to show that the Kesef Mishnah and the Shulchan Aruch held the same thing. Like, there are two writings here that wrote the same thing. And you can imagine some of the more learned boys there just literally cracking up in her face. And she was like highly insulted why they're cracking up in her face until somebody told her that, this was simply an expression of lack of knowledge. The Kesef Mishnah is a work of Rabbi Yosef Karo. And that's why it's borderline Rishonic Afro. Okay. The other very important work that again, sets up its own codification of halacha, is the work of Rabbi Yaakov ben Harosh, the same Rabbi Yaakov ben Harosh that we mentioned before that wrote the Kitzur Piskei Harosh. Yaakov ben Harosh writes the book that we know today as the Tur, or the Turim, the Arba Turim. As opposed to the Rambam, Yaakov ben Harosh writes a halachic book that is focused only on the relevant halachot bizman hazeh. But he takes that broad realm of halacha and divides it into arba turim, four columns. Those arba turim are names that most Orthodox Jews are familiar with: Yorah Chaim, Yoredeya, Evin Ezer, and Choshen Mishpat. Okay. Some people think that this was the Shulchan Aruch who created this structure, and that's not correct. The structure is created by Yaakov ben Harosh in Spain, and he writes his book to create a guidebook, la halacha, practical halacha, but as opposed to the Rambam, who just brings down the halacha, the Tur does bring in a certain level of the discourse, or even more importantly, and that indicates that there's a certain lateness in his position of the Tur. It's already a later Rishon, middle to late Rishon, who writes and brings in already the earlier Rishon. He'll bring down the key issue of the Sugya, he'll bring down the different views of the Rishonim that dealt and lead to the conclusion. Many times the conclusion is based on what he writes, the Katav Avi Adoni Harosh, right? When you see in the Torah, the Katav Aleph, Aleph, it means Avi Adoni. He obviously and reasonably rules a lot like his father, the Rosh. But not always, and he's independent in his ruling. And his book became one of the central halachic books as far as halachic ruling. Also, to the Tur, there are several books of commentary that were written, but both because the Tur himself is later, and whatever influence existed, to the best of my knowledge, most, if not all, the commentary on the Tur is already from the Achronic period. The only one who's borderline again is Rabbi Yosef Karo, who writes his Beit Yosef, his big mega opus work in Halacha, on the basis of the Tur. And that's why the Beit Yosef uses the Tur as his basis. Therefore, his work is divided to the same four sections of the Tur, Yor Chaim, Yoredeya, Evin Ezer, and Choshen Mishpat. And that later affects also the Shulchan Aruch, which in turn became so accepted as the central book of halachic ruling that today most halachic work is written on the premise of these four sections. And therefore, the work of the Tur, beyond its own position and its value in halachic ruling, is also significant and important in the fact that the Tur created the halachic codification and division, which includes not only the four Turim, but the different areas of halacha, the different simanim, all of that is based on the work of Rabbi Yaakov ben Harosh in his Sefer HaTur. The few minutes that I have left, let me mention a few other books that were written in Rishonic time, again, on topical, more topical. One important such book is the Ramban's work, the Torah HaAdam. appears in the Kitvei HaRamban of the Mosad Hav Kook. The book deals primarily in areas beginning from a person who's sick, halachot that have to do with a sick person, and bikur cholim, and then if it leads to death, kvura, avelut, avelut yeshana, which also brings him into the whole issues of Tisha B'Av and Taniyot. It's a in-depth halachic discussion that brings in the different sugyot and leads to the Ramban's halachic conclusions. Another important image in Sephardic halacha is the Rashba. The Rashba is a contemporary of the Rosh. The Rashba is probably most known in his halachic area for his tshuvot. He has this immense, he's got thousands of tshuvot. It's literally several volumes. It's one of the biggest collections, if not the biggest collection, of tshuvot that exist. But he also wrote another book of importance in halacha, the Torah Habayit. The Torah Habayit deals with areas of shchita, taharuvot, netilat yadayim, and dinei tahara. The Torah Habayit becomes a certain basis for halachic discussion. It is also a significant source of halacha ruling in those areas, but it also becomes sort of a cycle of discussion because the Ra'ah, who lived in the 13th century, writes his reservations. He had some very strong reservations to the Rashba's opinion in the Torah Habayit, Bedek Habayit. Being their contemporaries, we find that there is a unnamed response to the Bedek Habayit called the Mishmeret Habayit. Right? So we have Torah Habayit, Bedek Habayit, in other words, let me fix up all the faults in the house, and Mishmeret Habayit, let me preserve the house as it is, which is usually actually associated to the Rashba himself. In other words, the Rashba saw, according to this opinion, the Rashba saw the comments of the Ra'a and responded to them in his Mishmeret Habayit. In any case, these are two, the Rashba and the Ramban, right? Two very important works that affect those areas that they dealt with, affect the ruling of posting for generations to this day significantly, and they mold in many areas the direction of halacha as such. Okay, that's it for the discussion on Sifrei Halacha. As I said, we only touched some. There are many other Sifrei Halacha in the Rishonic period, but it gave us some kind of a feel of the world of the halachic works in the Rishonic period. We will conclude the next week with a few more things on the Rishonim and then move on a little bit to the Achronim.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you very much.